Yes, it's 9/11, but it's also 10 days before the massive People's Climate March. Let's start the countdown. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for September 11th, 2014. On the Ground lifts up voices of activists and activism here in the nation's capital. I'm your host, Esther Averam, here on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. Today, environmental justice, justice for the planet, and for human survival. 10 days from now, tens of thousands are expected to gather in New York City for the People's Climate March, the largest mobilization of people demanding immediate action on climate change. We'll talk to a D.C. area organizer for the march and something a little different for On the Ground. Here's excerpts from the powerful movie Disruption, which is really an unflinching examination of the climate crisis and a behind-the-scenes look at organizing for the big march. But first, our headlines. On this anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon on September 11, 2001, the activists of Engineers and Architects for 9/11 Truth are holding a series of actions around the country, including the launch of a massive digital Times Square ad campaign and the premiere of a new film titled Anatomy of a Great Deception, How the Building 7 Paradox Woke Me Up. The local premiere will be tonight at 9 p.m. at the Bus Boys and Poets at 5th and K Streets in the County Cullen Room. And just like climate researchers, the activists of Engineers and Architects for 9/11 Truth are committed to dispelling misinformation and disinformation with scientific facts and forensic evidence. Educating and motivating thousands of architects and engineers as well as the public at large, and obtaining a truly independent World Trade Center investigation with subpoena power. On the website ae911truth.org, they say the truth movement can be good for America by stopping so much that has resulted from 9/11, including wars of aggression, an economy wrecked by illegal war, NSA spying, as well as policies of torture and rendition that have further weakened our moral footing and ruined our international reputation. In Ferguson, Missouri, another witness to the shooting death of unarmed Missouri teen Michael Brown is speaking out for the first time. Both the man and his co-worker said they were working outside an apartment complex on August 9th. Like the other witness recounts, those provided by these two workers failed to paint a picture of Brown charging at Wilson, as the officer's defense has claimed. Both men had submitted statements to the St. Louis County Police and FBI. Also, as a recent report on ESPN detailed another incident of abuse and brutality by police officer Darren Wilson against an unarmed black teen and his father, protesters in Ferguson spoke out at the first meeting of the Ferguson City Council, which unveiled reforms including a citizen review board and others that could lessen the economic impact of tickets, fines, and warrants that have targeted the city's poor black residents to fill its coffers. Protesters also blocked a highway on Wednesday near Ferguson, calling for the arrest of Darren Wilson and a special prosecutor in the case. An Oklahoma City police officer accused of sexually assaulting 8 African-American women while on duty has been released from jail. Daniel Holzclaw was released on Friday after posting $500,000 in bond. He is accused of carrying out the alleged assaults after threatening victims with arrest if they did not comply with his sexual demands. And on this 9th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, Cam Edwards, host of the National Rifle Association's news show, claims that after Katrina, residents of the New Orleans neighborhood of Algiers, quote, were looking out for each other by walking the streets armed with firearms, end quote. But according to a federal hate crimes indictment and numerous media reports, after Katrina, white gun-toting vigilantes in Algiers targeted African Americans with racially motivated violence. in Algiers Point during the days after Katrina, at least 11 people were shot. In each case, the targets were African-American men, while the shooters, it appears, were all white, according to The Nation. Some of the gunmen prowling Algiers Point were out to wage a race war, said one woman, whose uncle and two cousins joined the cause. A former Orleanian, the source spoke anonymously because she feared her relatives could be prosecuted for their crimes. She said, quote, "My uncle was very excited that it was a free-for-all, white against black, that he could participate in," end quote, said the woman. For him, the opportunity to hunt black people was a joy. No one has ever been convicted for the murders of black people by white vigilantes after Hurricane Katrina. More information about this report is at MediaMatters.org. And speaking of media, here again in our moment of culture media is with me here is Richard Prince, editor, writer of Journalism's Column, who is watching coverage of the Baltimore running back Ray Rice and the issues of domestic violence. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. How you doing?
All right, all right. So what's the latest in terms of media and this Ray Rice case?
Well, the Associated Press reported yesterday that the NFL actually had received that that video 3 months ago, even if the NFL denies that they had seen it. There have been, you know, a lot of allegations that you know, the NFL was trying to look the other way with all these cases of domestic violence among the players, and that it was only that when they came upon a video that no one could ignore that they actually acted decisively about it. But in addition to that, the whole issue of domestic violence has now risen to the surface among people's consciousness because of the actions of TMZ, which is the website, celebrity gossip website, that posted that video. And it's also spawned some interesting racial commentary in that the people involved were African-American, and some people are saying that, well, this is demeaning the African-American woman involved, putting all of her business out there when she doesn't want it out there. But others are saying, you know, black women have the highest rate of partner homicide, and even if they do not want this information out there, it should be to save other people's lives.
You know, I'm thinking, you know, because we've been covering Ferguson so much, I'm really, I guess, I don't know if conflicted is the right word, but it's just the whole idea of Ray Rice being made the poster boy for not only domestic violence, but for violence, period, and having his livelihood taken away. While we have Darren Wilson, who is not somehow being made this poster boy for violence, even though he killed someone, and he's still being paid, and he hasn't had his livelihood taken away. In terms of this kind of larger iconography, you know, that happens with the media, that's one of the things that's really troubling me.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but he will get his due process. I mean, that Darren Wilson case is not over. And the other thing about athletes that's different from the Darren Wilson case is that these are role models for young people and who model their behavior after them. And so therefore they are held to a higher standard than even, you know, a policeman in our community.
Wow, you know, when I grew up, and I guess, you know, times have really changed, but at one time police were considered role models also. And in a lot of communities, they still are, I suppose, you know, and we kind of take it for granted that they're not
right
now.
Right, wow. Well, at least not that individual policeman is not, I mean, right. People don't walk around with Darren Wilson t-shirts unless you're, you know, some kind of strange kind of person. That's what I'm saying.
Right. Well, you know, it's getting pretty close out there online. There was a website I looked at right before I came on YouTube. There was a video that some kids from Ferguson put up called, you know, it's kind of like, you know, attention white people, you know, racism's not over, but I'm over racism, something like that. It was really cute. Like the kids were like age 9 to 13. And so there's all this controversy because all these kind of like, you know, neo-Nazis, you know, racists, ultra-racists are posting under the kids' video all this just virulent horrible stuff. And I'm actually wondering why people allow people to comment on their videos, because you can put the most innocuous thing up there. If you're black, you know, the racists will come and, you know, start, you know, spilling their poison.
That's true. And that's why some sites no longer allow commenting.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Richard. I know you'll continue to follow Ray Rice, and I'm a little weary of it, but I know it's
not just Ray Rice. That's the thing. So there'll be more coming. People are saying, what about these other athletes?
Right. Well, what about, you know, other people who aren't athletes, too? I mean,
well, what about them? You're right.
It's just not, you know, making him the poster boy really disturbs me. Anyway, thank you, Richard.
Okay. Thanks, Esther.
Thanks so much. Now, when we come back, part one of our run-up to the People's Climate March, excerpts from the powerful movie Disruption. Stay with us. That was Almighty Dollar by Ozzy Osbourne on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition here on WPFW 89.3 Washington. I'm Esther Averam. Well, in the movie Disruption that we are about to hear excerpts from, one scientist talks about how we humans have an almost cut-off switch in our brains when it comes to an issue as massive as climate change. It is literally too big an issue with too many parts for us to hold in our hands, with all the rest of what we have to contend with in our daily lives, bills, spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever, jobs. But Disruption urges us to meet this challenge of our generation. 10 days from now, on September 21st, tens of thousands are expected to gather in New York City for the People's Climate March, the largest mobilization of people demanding immediate action on climate change. Organizers say this about the march: people coming together to show that we demand a future that is within our reach, a future with an economy that works for people and the planet. The march is happening 2 days before the United Nations Climate Summit, a special meeting for world heads of state called by UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon. Filmmakers Kelly Nikes and Jared P. Scott have produced the movie, which pulls no punches in examining the climate crisis. It also gives a behind-the-scenes look at organizing for the big march. This is an excerpt from Disruption.
Dramatic evidence of what's happening to our world. And tonight we'll look at the impact already being felt.
The red flags about extreme weather we've all endured together all across the globe.
We are literally engaged in an unprecedented experiment with the one planet that we know of that can support life.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations.
The big question mark is the future, of course, and a new kind of normal.
UN-hosted climate change summit in New York. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will host the summit.
I will convene a climate summit for leaders at the highest level. I urge political leaders of the world to prioritize their political energy on climate change.
We have to get serious about bringing real commitments to the table for that summit.
If things go business as usual, we will not live, we will die.
On September 23rd, the United Nations is holding a historic climate summit where they've invited world leaders and heads of state from around the world We're trying to organize the largest ever climate rally on the streets of New York in response to this, hopefully turning the tide of what comes out of that summit and reshaping what the entire climate movement looks like going forward.
Climate tipping points are scary, but if we stay connected to each other, we can build the largest climate mobilization in history. We'll have power to create the movement tipping point on climate change, the one that takes our leaders from this place of inaction and puts them on a journey towards saving the planet.
All of the big social movements in history have had people in the streets. Women's voting rights, civil rights movement, and even more recently on climate issues, our big successes have happened when people left their homes and went out into the streets.
This is a bigger fight than, in fact, has ever been won. It's not that we need to save the Earth. We need to save the systems that make the Earth compatible with human existence and the existence of other life forms.
This is the fight of our time. None of us should exactly have to be activists about all this. In a rational world, the fact that scientists had said the worst thing on Earth is happening now, and here's what you can do to stop it, that would have been enough to push our systems into action.
Yeah, of all the things that probably get me most upset, it's when people start presenting climate change as if it's something new. The science behind our understanding of man-made climate change is very, very old and very well established. So the task we've taken on is documenting this history to help us understand where we are, how we got here, and how we can change course. Scientists have known for more than 150 years that carbon dioxide was a greenhouse gas.
Fourier came up with this notion that there were gases in our atmosphere that allowed sunlight to pass through like a window. But then when sunlight bounced off the Earth's surface, they trapped the heat in, right? So you had now this establishment of what we now call the greenhouse effect.
In the 1850s, John Tyndall made laboratory measurements of the absorption of heat radiation by carbon dioxide. And he concluded that if you change the CO2 in the atmosphere, it's going to affect the planetary energy balance.
Tyndall was the one who really came along and proved that carbon dioxide was a natural thermostat that helped set our planet's temperature.
In the late 1800s, it was the great Swedish chemist Arrhenius who first did the calculations about what would happen as we, as he put it, evaporated our coal mines into the air. But people didn't pay much attention to that in the 20th century because we were too busy figuring out cool new ways to burn fossil fuel. It was only in the late 1950s that we even bothered to measure to see if it was accumulating in the atmosphere. That instrument, which went up on the side of Mauna Loa in Hawaii, is the most important scientific instrument in the world. Beginning in 1959, it found that there was a steadily accumulating amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, the so-called Keeling curve.
The Keeling curve is one of the most important pieces of scientific work of the 20th century that shows us that carbon dioxide has been rising, continuously and systematically since the Industrial Revolution.
Keeling didn't just show that there was an increase in carbon dioxide, he also pinpointed the source. And what Keeling showed so incredibly was that roughly one out of every four CO2 molecules in our atmosphere today were put there by us.
Just a year ago, we passed 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, the pre-industrial level was about 280 parts per million. So human society in the industrial era has raised the level of CO2 in the atmosphere by about 40%, and many people fear that before we're done, we're going to double it or even triple it.
We're pumping CO2 into the atmosphere at a speed which we have never seen before in modern human history. We are absolutely racing into uncharted territory.
In our lifetime, human beings left behind the Holocene, this 10,000-year period of benign climatic stability that coincides with the rise of human civilization. We have crossed a great threshold, and we stand on the edge of others.
I remember when the Weather Channel was this kind of like nice, sleepy little station. Now it's like a horror show. The climate is being disrupted. That's not for next year or 1,000 years from now. That's happening right now.
what all climate scientists will agree on is that the entire atmosphere has changed. All the atmospheric dynamics have changed. So every event that happens now is in the context of climate change, is different from how it would have been.
Slammed into the Philippines with winds of 195 miles per hour. That's higher than the winds from Hurricane Sandy and Katrina combined.
The world is mobilizing to help the Philippines, but just a trickle of food and water and medicine has reached the victims of Typhoon Haiyan.
More than a million people were forced to flee their homes, many now trying to salvage what's left.
Hundreds of thousands are thronging relief centers, desperate for life's necessities.
Many residents covered their faces to mask the smell of the dead while they searched for relatives in some of the hardest hit areas.
This is one of the top storms ever seen on this planet.
Mr. President, Your Excellency, what my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. Super Typhoon Haiyan made landfall in my own family's hometown. And the devastation is staggering. I struggle to find words to describe how I feel about the losses. To anyone outside who continues to deny and ignore the reality that is climate change, I dare them. I dare them to get off their ivory towers and away from the comfort of their armchairs. I dare them to go to the islands of the Pacific. We refuse as a nation to accept a future where super typhoons like Haiyan become a way of life. We refuse to accept that running away from storms, evacuating our families, counting our dead become a way of life. We simply refuse to. We can fix this. We can stop this madness.
You're listening to excerpts of the movie Disruption by Kelly Nikes and Jared P. Scott, produced as a run-up to the People's Climate March, which will be held September 21st in New York City, 2 days before the United Nations Climate Summit. I'm your host, Esther Avaram, here on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. In this next section of the film, activists break down how people and the planet are paying the true costs of fossil fuels.
A tremendous amount of work has happened, is happening every day, getting the word out, organizing people, mobilizing people. At this point, every day counts. And every day when we miss an opportunity, it's gone.
Because it's not just a one-day march, it's our long-term ability to build a strong climate movement that we need to invest in. So being inclusive to us is really about multiple things, but recognizing that we live in a society where there's privilege, there are inequities. In order to address the climate crisis, we have to first address those inequities that will allow us to then bring a movement strong enough to address the global ecological crisis.
If you think for a second about this, there was this just layer of stuff under the ground, got put there at a specific time in a specific way, and it just captured millennia of solar energy. And we just happened upon it. It's like if you were just walking around and then like, oh, you put something in the ground, there's just millions of dollar bills down there. You're just like pulling them out. Everything about what we do and who we are and how we live is dependent upon the fact that we just found this stuff sitting there. And that stuff said, oh, you don't have to have everyone working in the fields all the time. You can have cities, you can have cars, you can have iPhones. And the way I view it is, as incredible as that stuff is, we've been paying this price on it the whole time, right? And there's this clock running.
The classic market failure is negative environmental externalities. That's just jargon for you're not paying the full costs of the fossil fuels that you burn.
The racket that the fossil fuel industry has run is to take costs of its product and export them to the public.
think about, you know, the litany of impacts from sea level rise, ocean acidification, the collapse of ecosystems that we rely on for food, water availability. These things are really expensive. When you have huge wildfires, it costs a lot of money. All of those costs are being dumped onto us as a society and not being paid by people who are polluting.
These big, massive polluters get to dump megatons of carbon in the atmosphere for free. You can't pollute for free. If you litter, you get a fine.
That makes coal and oil and other fossil fuels more competitive against solar and wind and other sources than they deserve to be. Behind the environmental problems that carbon pollution causes and behind the economic problems is a political problem that a very small group of very powerful special interests have exerted very rough control over the political establishment.
We're up against the fossil fuel lobby that has complete access to the political class and the ability to bribe through legal means and blackmail through the use of attack ads and so on. Even people who oppose them have trouble opposing them too strongly because they're in some ways economically dependent on them.
Right now, we have a monopoly control by big carbon polluters. They grant themselves subsidy after subsidy. Think about this. How much money does the Pentagon spend helping big private oil companies get their for-profit products from the Middle East here? About half the Pentagon's budget is just helping Chevron and Shell and Exxon get their for-profit product here. What if they had to pay for that service? How much would gas cost then? Plus, they also get all kind of tax breaks and other kind of loopholes.
They're in a system based on a grow or die ethic. But rather than respond to the climate crisis by scaling back, they're doubling down through fracking, through tar sands oil, through coal exports, mountaintop removal. They have become more brazen.
It's a rogue industry. It's an industry whose business plan is followed to the letter will wreck the planet. Once you know that, then you know that these are now illegitimate business plans. We have to figure out how to disassociate ourselves with them. And that is beginning to happen all over the world.
On the great lawn of Central Park, I was up on a stage probably 70 feet in the air, looking out at that sea of people stretching out farther than the eye could see. The crowd estimates later were larger than 1 million people.
April 22nd, 1970. The grassroots mobilization, which we recall as the first Earth Day. 20 million Americans called away from their jobs and their classes into the streets of their communities.
When Nixon was looking at television at these huge crowds in city after city after city across the country, he apparently muttered to Ehrlichman, man, a lot of those people have got to be Republican. And Republicans needed him to do something for them on this issue, he felt, and it was Nixon, arguably one of the most anti-environmental presidents in American history, who felt compelled to sign the Clean Air Act.
I think the things that we've been doing to date are a reason to give us a little bit of hope. We've seen a degree of responsiveness on the part of now of the House of Representatives and on the part of the U.S. Senate.
In a matter of 3 years, we passed the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, National Environmental Policy Act, the Environmental Education Act, a Superfund. I'd go so far as to say that with the possible exception of the New Deal, it was the most fundamental restructuring of the ground rules of the American economic system that the nation has experienced.
All right, folks, we are 50 days away from the largest climate march in history. Are you all ready?
Yeah!
This is not just about the environment. It's about the community. It's about public health. It's about jobs. It's about justice.
It was labor that got this city up and moving.
Yes! Yes!
And it'll be labor that continues to move this city. We are the community. Are we not the community?
Yes!
For our people who have been at the front line, not being able to breathe, suffering from asthma, upper respiratory, pulmonary disease, cancer clusters because of environmental racism.
Climate change exacerbates every kind of social injustice.
that faith communities have fought against for thousands of years. And we will not stop marching and praying and acting until we have a strong climate treaty.
We got a movement, brothers and sisters, and we got to stay together.
So join us on the 21st to march and send that signal to the United Nations.
The people united will never be defeated. The people unido jamás será vencido.
It's only by accident that we even think of climate change as an environmental issue. You could just as easily think of it as another example of what happens in an unequal society. The people who've contributed the least to climate change and who've benefited the least from the use of fossil fuel are the first people to feel the effects. People in the poorest parts of the world suffer enormously already and will suffer enormously more as the century wears on.
Climate disruption is a social justice issue. Who gets hit first and worst? Every time there's one of these weather disasters, it's low-income people, it's people of color, it's people who can't get out of harm's way, and people who can't bounce back easily because they don't have the money or the social standing or the political connections.
Our communities are disproportionately impacted. We're all seeing that it's the indigenous people, the people of color, the low-income people who have historically suffered the burden of so many other politically driven crises.
There are so many countries that have been systematically plundered over hundreds of years, and this is often described as an ecological debt, climate debt. The whole idea that there are disposable places was always a racist idea, the idea of sacrifice zones, just treating people in places like garbage.
The place where it's hardest for it to sink in is in the suburban United States. We're insulated against the natural world. That's what the suburbs really are, a way of making you not notice the natural world very much. And we're insulated in those places by wealth. At least we think we are.
Scientists are screaming from the rooftops about us avoiding going over a 2-degree rise in the temperature of the planet. Why are they so worried about that? If we go over that amount of warming, there are feedback loops in our ecosystems, tipping points that climate change could spin out of control, and it happens like that.
There are switches that can be tripped where suddenly you are in brand new territory and you don't even begin to know what to do about it. This is not a linear kind of problem that we're dealing with. This is very much an exponential kind of problem.
Right now, we're on the edge of 3 major tipping points. The first one is the Arctic ice cap. That ice cap's like a mirror. It reflects the sun's light off of the Earth and keeps it from warming us up. But as it melts, you get a smaller mirror, which means a warmer Earth, which means more melting, which means more climate change. Another example is Arctic methane. We've got a gigantic amount of methane gas frozen into the tundra, and it is 50 times as toxic as CO2 is. It's CO2 on steroids. As it warms, and that methane gets released, it then causes global warming to get worse, which means it warms more, which means more methane released, which means worse warming, and all of that process spins out of control. Another example of a tipping point is ocean acidification. As you get more CO2 in the atmosphere, a lot of it actually is going into our oceans. And a lot of stuff, like plankton, can't live in that kind of acidified water. And plankton is the basis of the food chain. If the plankton die, we lose the whole ocean ecosystem.
These kinds of feedback loops and tipping points are what keep me up at night, that we will hit one before we're able to turn things around.
Even if we went cold turkey today because of the time lags in our climate system, we've already signed up for things that we can't see yet.
We live in a razor-thin livable universe. Just a few kilometers below my feet, it's too hot to live. Just a few kilometers above my head, the air is too thin to breathe. It's not about a few more droughts and a few more storms. It's about a catastrophic shift in this fragile balance of our biosphere that threatens everything we love.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. I'm your host, Esther Verum, and we're listening to excerpts of the movie Disruption. I said disrupt earlier, produced as a run-up to the People's Climate March, which will be held September 21st. In New York City, 2 days before the United Nations Climate Summit. When we come back, it's your turn, so you can call 202-588-0893 to comment on our topic today. What are your comments about the emerging coalition to fight climate change? What do you think is needed? What must be done to save our planet? What is your comment on the catastrophic climate changes happening on our planet? 202-588-0893 is the number to call, and we'll be right back. That was Only So Much Oil in the Ground by Tower of Power on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. I'm your host, Esther Averam, and it's your turn, so you can call 202-588-0893 to comment on our topic today, the People's Climate March, which will be held September 21st in New York City, 2 days before the United Nations Climate Summit. What are your comments about the emerging coalition to fight climate change? What do you think is needed? What must be done to save our planet? What's your comment on the catastrophic climate changes happening? 202-588-0893. Now, this week, I also spoke to Ted Glick. He's National Campaign Coordinator from the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, an environmental activist here, activist organization here in the DMV, who we talked to around the issues of the controversial liquefied natural gas export facility proposed for Cove Point earlier this year. And I'll be playing part one of a conversation I had with him about the movement around climate change and the issues of economic and social justice. But we have lots of callers right now, so we'll go to the lines right now. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Oh, hello. This is Mary, and I'm calling from Arlington, Virginia.
Yeah. And good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for trying to pep people up on what's happening and making it accessible to them verbally. Basically, I wanted to first comment on your song, Tower of Power. It's great that there's only so much oil on the ground, but actually there's not. The problems that we're already seeing in terms of pollution and climate change are going to stop us before the oil in the ground, or they're going to radically change our way of life. I think what we need to do, and what I hope the rally does, is to expose the fact that there are a lot of people. This is not a matter of 38% of the population believes that there's climate change, because it's not a matter of belief. And we need to demand a national energy policy. The United States needs to come up with a strategy to assume a leadership role in attacking climate change at a global level. Okay. We shouldn't be attacking it. We shouldn't be engaged in other forms of leadership before we attack this global imperative.
Okay. Thank you for that comment. Next caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
I'm Jeff from Waldorf, Maryland.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. To reiterate what the other caller said, thank you for having this forum. We have to pull all these environmental issues together. People say, well, that's going to divide our effort, but they're all important. Against nuclear weapons, against nuclear power. Unfortunately, the president is wrong on the nuclear power position, and you can see that because there's a dirty coal fire plant right in Washington, D.C. Everyone would like to get rid of that. but they're hypocrites, because if they support nuclear power like the president and most of the Congress does, they're not going to put a nuclear power plant right there in Washington either. So we need to unite on all these environmental fronts, and it's not going to divide our effort. It's important to be anti-nuclear in terms of weapons and the power, and cleaning up the big mess we have with nuclear power. You know, almost 100 plants in the country, waste pools. We don't have a permanent deposit, repository or site to put those things in. So, you know, and climate change is obviously very important too. So I would just say a second and last comment would be, everyone has a role to play. Little things matter. You know, people, I see people all the time using the little electronic buttons you push to open up the doors to offices or libraries or whatever. That mounts up. You don't need that. That's for handicapped people. That's for, you know, and another thing, all the Christmas lights, all these things that people are doing, they say, oh, you know, what the heck? I want to enjoy Christmas. I would just say, decorate your house in a way where you're not going to put a million lights on it. You know, you can use traditional decorations. You can use, fair trade, so to speak, artistic crafts to decorate your house. Yeah, you can have a few lights on there, but little things people can do every day, walk, take a bus instead of driving on a short trip. You say, well, I'm not going to do that every day. Okay, well, take a bike every once in a while. So anyway, that's my point. Thanks very much for the forum.
Okay, and thank you for calling. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. I think we have another caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Connie from Annandale.
Hi, Connie.
Yes, I wanted to point out that I'm one of those people who live in the suburbs who is insulated, as are my neighbors. I continue to see the large automobiles purchased, the trucks, as if this makes no difference in our environment. I continue to see them using chemicals on their lawns. It is indeed that we are isolated, and I think that the environmental groups have failed us, that there are tons of money going to these groups, the Audubon Society, the Wilderness Society, et cetera, et cetera. And now they say to us in their letters, we can get some action because we have essentially established ourselves in playing footsie with the power people. I think they need to step up and to actually state the issues and as a group push this country and inform our next generation. I just saw an AARP survey. The millennium generation is less concerned about the environment than any of the previous generations. Stunning.
Okay, thank you for that call, Connie. One more caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes, my name is Hamid, calling you from D.C.
Good morning.
And, good morning. I believe that what we're experiencing here really is we need a increase in consciousness. Right now we're experiencing a tragic all-time low in consciousness where many individuals have adopted the traits of businesses. Like people don't have connections and friendships, relations. Right now they want fans and followers, and it's about materialism. And so, I mean, I think that we're emulating the source of the problem, which is big business and money. Everyone wants to be a rock star today. It's a tragically painful low level of consciousness in the world today.
Okay.
And so when we increase that, we'll be on the road to making some progress.
Okay. Thank you, Hamid. Well, I mentioned earlier this week I spoke to Ted Glick, and he's national campaign coordinator from the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and those are environmentalists here in the DMV, who we talked to earlier this year around the issues of the controversial liquefied natural gas export facility proposed for Cove Point, and they're fighting that. So this is part one of a conversation I had with him about the movement and the around climate change and the issues of economic and social justice.
One of the things that I'm really interested in is how holistically people look at the climate issue. Can we actually make progress on the climate under capitalism?
I think we can. Actually, I do think we can. I think we have to, because I don't think we're going to have a different system, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years. And what happens in the next 5 or 10 years is really, really critical in terms of us having a chance of avoiding climate catastrophe. What can happen, though, in the course of, you know, that 5 to 10 years is that kind of almost in tandem or kind of parallel with a climate movement that has all kinds of different approaches that people are using. In addition to that, or kind of parallel to it, you can have a movement growing that is about a different kind of a society that's not about kind of greed and power and me first and so on, but it really is much more about community and concern for the earth and all of the life forms of the earth and equality. Those principles the movement that's based on those principles can be growing, and the organizing that's rooted in those principles can be growing and becoming more and more connected, and hopefully being then therefore more and more visible as a force that exists that can keep growing and building at the same time. I mean, I think that a lot of what needs to happen in order to solve the climate crisis pretty organically leads to a different kind of a society, because you can't have these kind of centralized, powerful, you know, fossil fuel industry corporations running your energy system. You just can't. You have to move away to a much more kind of locally distributed energy, as it's called, like putting, you know, solar panels on rooftops everywhere or other places where the power is much more locally focused and people literally have more power over their power, as opposed to being dependent upon these powerful players somewhere else. So, you know, it kind of leads to a different type of a way of organizing society that's much more progressive, much more positive for people and for all life forms.
That was Ted Glick, National Campaign Coordinator from the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, environmental activist here in the DMV. And we're also taking your calls right now at 202-588-0893. We're doing a run-up to the People's Climate March, which will be held September 21st in New York City, 2 days before the United Nations Climate Summit. So we're asking you, what are your comments about the emerging coalition to fight climate change? You know, what do you think is needed? What must be done to save our planet? What is your comment on these changes happening on our planet? The number to call is 202-588-0893. And we have one more clip from Ted Glick that we can go to right now.
We've been talking a lot on our show about Ferguson and issues of police brutality, police militarization, the use of our resources, our public resources being channeled into one direction as opposed to another direction that we consider more in terms of human needs like education, infrastructure, in the environment. So will the People's Climate March connect these issues?
You know, again, it's a very big tent, right, the People's Climate March. And there are, I don't know how many contingents they're going to end up being. Last I heard, there were about 100 hubs is what they're called. You know, there's like a fracking hub, for example. Groups right. that are fighting fracking are having conference calls, have an email list, and are getting organized to march together. And then there's the environmental justice hub, and there's a religious hub, and et cetera. You know, there's an anti-corporate hub, and just a whole mix of them. So each of those will have their own specific kind of orientation in terms of signs that they carry, maybe, you know, what they chant, certainly. There'll be differences in that sense. So, you know, it's not like the climate march is this kind of, it's not at all homogenous. I mean, it's right. You know, it's in many ways it's a temporary coalition. I don't know if as a coalition it will continue afterwards necessarily. I mean, I think a lot of the connections that have happened will continue in whatever forms that takes. So that's right. That's positive. But I actually just learned myself a few days ago that a decision had been made that the environmental justice contingent is going to lead the march, to be the leading contingent. And that's a good sign, I think, in terms of, you know, what's happening with this movement, that it saw the importance of kind of recognizing, you know, that constituency and the issues that they've been dealing with for a long time that sometimes have been basically ignored by some of the older, you know, white, more established environmental groups that have just not taken seriously issues most affecting communities of color and low-income people.
Right.
Well, that was that talk. And, you know, we have a little bit of news to report in relationship to the People's Climate March. Actually, the United Nations just released a report saying that levels of greenhouse gases responsible for global warming have reached a new record high. According to the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rose by nearly 3 parts per million from 2012 to 2013, the largest single-year increase since detailed records began 3 decades ago. Last year, concentrations of carbon dioxide reached nearly 400 parts per million, the highest level in at least 800,000 years. As oceans absorb the increased carbon, ocean acidification has reached a rate that is unprecedented, at least over the last 300 million years. In a press release, WMO Secretary General Michael Gerard called the data a scientific base for global action on climate change. "We're running out of time," he said. The report comes ahead of the UN Climate Summit and the People's Climate March in New York City later this month. Thousands are mobilized for the People's Climate March, which we've been mentioning all this show, and which is online at peoplesclimatemarch.org. And that's, again, peoplesclimatemarch.org. So 202-588-0893 is the number to call if you want to join our callers we had today. One other note that I found, Mike, when I was preparing for the show, kind of sad. The National Marine Fisheries Service announced that the orange clownfish, the species popularized, you know, for a generation of children by the movie Finding Nemo, well, may warrant protection under the U.S. Endangered Species Act because of the threats from global warming and ocean acidification. The service will now conduct a status review to decide whether the clownfish will be protected under the act. The decision responds to a 2012 scientific petition by the Center for Biological Diversity seeking the act's protection for 8 reef fish species. And one of those species is the orange clownfish and 7 species of damselfish that occur in U.S. waters. So, Finding Nemo. Okay, so that was part one of our run-up to the People's Climate March today. And we're going to continue some more next week. And I want to thank all the callers and all the listeners this morning. And that'll do it for us today on the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment. I'm Esther Avaram, your host. Thanks again to our engineer, Mike Nasella. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our past shows. And please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Stay tuned for Askia Muhammad with the news, followed by Crisp the Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Peace. Thank you.